Our guest this hour says the food police are trying to take over your refrigerator, and we will wonder if you have any problem with that. I'm Joy Curdine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good to have you with us on this Thursday, April 18th. We have heard from lots of guests on this program who promote organic foods and eating locally and seasonally. Guests who decry genetically modified foods and processed foods. Guests who support regulating or taxing, labeling foods that are considered unhealthy, like sugary drinks and fatty fast foods. Today, we are going to get another perspective from the author of a book, The Food Police, a well-fed manifesto about the politics of your plate. And we'll welcome your questions for him. Maybe your challenges at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk at WPR.org. You can also post on the Joy Curdine Show Facebook page. Our guest is Jason Lusk. He's a professor and endowed chair of the Agricultural Economics Department at Oklahoma State University, and he is the author of The Food Police, a well-fed manifesto about the politics of your plate. Hello, and thank you for being with us.
Hi, Joy. Thanks for having me on.
First of all, who exactly are the food police?
Well, I sort of like to think about them as the backseat drivers when it comes to food. So I have in mind a group of people who sort of think, from my perspective, think they know better how you should be eating and how farmers should be farming. And they've been very influential in passing laws and advocating to legislators to pass laws, regulations, restrictions that the research shows in many cases are often going to do more harm than good.
Oh, but some of these people are scientists, aren't they?
They often are. I don't want to mischaracterize a lot of people that I'm referring to this book are well-meaning and they have a lot of good intentions. But often one key piece they're missing is the economics side of the equation. So you might have an expert on nutrition or epidemiology, and they might know a lot about how the body regulates sugar, for example, but they might not know a lot about how a sugar tax will actually work out, or they might not know a lot about the economics of requiring schools to source foods locally. So what I'm trying to do in this book is bring in the science, but also the economics, and ask for evidence-based policy decision-making.
When you say that they are trying to take over our refrigerator, how so? What do you mean?
Well, again, there's this idea, I believe, that sort of you mentioned all the guests that you've had on talking about a lot of these topics, and so they have a very definitive idea about the things that should be in our refrigerator. That's fine, and I think it's great when we can turn to experts and nutritionists and diet books to give us advice. But when we start passing regulations that require that we buy certain things, I think we're going to want to ask for evidence that those kinds of policies are actually going to create some benefit. So if you want some examples of policies, a soda tax, a fat tax is an example of one of them. And just to give you an example, the kinds of things I'm talking about is a lot of the economic research shows that those kind of taxes are going to have very trivial effects on what we weigh, and in some cases will have counterproductive effects. So for example, a tax on sugar might very well cause people, on sugary beverages, might very well cause people to switch to juice, or there's one study that showed people might increase their consumption of alcoholic beverages. And so people might even end up consuming more sugar. Moreover, taxes on food are very regressive, so the burden tends to be borne by those people that can least afford to pay it.
Yeah. Besides taxes, though, there have been a lot of efforts to have more information on what we are eating at, for instance, fast food restaurants, putting up labels, you know, menus showing what exactly the Whopper has in it, for example. Is there anything wrong with that, letting us know exactly what we're eating?
Certainly there's nothing wrong with a company doing that. The question is, do we want to force companies to do it? Do we want to mandate that they do it? In the case you mentioned McDonald's, actually McDonald's has been voluntarily doing that for years. So again, I'm asking for the research. So what does the research say about the effects of these labels? And actually, this is a topic that I've published some papers on myself in the academic literature. And you know, the evidence is a bit mixed, but, you know, my own studies and many others show that those labels just don't change behavior at all. And so essentially what you're doing is asking companies to undertake a cost for no discernible benefit to the consumer. And so, again, if this information was really valuable to consumers, I don't see anything prohibiting companies from advertising that on their menu, attracting companies who customers who want that information. And indeed, you already do see that kind of act working out sometimes in the marketplace. I don't know if they do it anymore, but companies like Applebee's, for example, used to put like the Weight Watcher points on their menus, and they did that presumably because customers wanted it, and those folks felt that they could gain some business by giving people the information they wanted. So I'm not advocating against not giving it. Information. My question is, do we want to mandate it? And I'm asking, when we mandate it, let's look at the evidence.
Mm-hmm. What's wrong with there was a mandate removing trans fats from products that they were considered very unhealthy? What's wrong with that?
Yeah, so again, I think the question is, what are the costs and benefits of those kind of policies? And I have to admit, I'm not an expert on that particular topic. So I'm not going to claim to be able to speak intelligently about that. But what I am saying is, in a more general sense, you know, that is an example of a whole host of policies that that are advocating health and whatnot. We just want to, all I'm saying is, we want to make sure that when we do those things, they're based on not only sound nutritional science but sound economic science.
Yeah. You say in the book that Michelle Obama's garden is a symbol of control over what we eat. What do you mean?
So I don't think I said her garden was a symbol of control. I think I said it was a symbolic nod to a growing food movement that seeks control. And what I'm saying, there's a small group, but very influential group of people that have a particular view about food that has been so influential that they convinced the First Lady to plant a White House garden. And this particular view about food is twofold. One, it's that it's sort of a, what I like to think about as sort of a romantic return to nature, that any new food technology is nefarious and bad, and that somehow farming would be better if we returned it to its state 50 years ago. And then this idea that everybody should be sort of eating the same, organic, local, slow, without consideration, in my mind, of each individual's own situation, their own preferences, their own desires. And I think in some cases, we have there's a sort of group of people that are imposing the preferences of sort of a upper middle class foodie mentality on people, many times they're just struggling to put food on the table.
Yeah, but someone like Michael Pollan, who says eat real food, not processed food, that there's something wrong with that?
Not necessarily. So I don't have any problem with Michael Pollan making food advice. My question is, do we want to turn to Michael Pollan, who's an outstanding journalist and a really incredible writer, but do we want to turn to him to be making food policy? Do we want to follow his advice when he says we should require schools to source their foods within 100 miles, or require local municipalities like jails or hospitals to source their foods locally? That's the kind of thing I'm objecting to, because when I look at the evidence of whether those things are going to create the kind of benefits that are claimed, I just don't see any support for it.
Yeah, I didn't realize that he was saying we ought to require this, but in any case, what would be wrong with that?
So let's take local foods. For example, and this is something this has been a quote of his several times. Actually, he had a whole article about 4 or 5 years ago entitled "Farmer in Chief," where he outlines a whole prescription of policies that he mm-hmm. advocates. So it's not the case that he's just offering private consumption advice. And as I said, I don't have any problem with that. There are thousands of diet books on the market or advice books, and I think those are great. But when you're going to start spending my tax dollars and everybody else's tax dollars are restricting my choices, then I think I have a reason to step in and sort of speak up a little bit. So let's talk about his local food pronouncement. So, what are the arguments that... So I think, first of all, buying local food is great. If you want to do it, I do it. I go to my farmer's market, and I enjoy buying from farmers I know. But the question is, do we want to subsidize it? Do we want to require it? Do I want to subsidize your neighbor's purchase of local asparagus? And So the question is, what arguments would we need to justify that? And the arguments that are put forward are often not very compelling, like local foods are better for the environment. Well, actually, the research there is very shaky. That people think, well, it's traveled fewer miles, so it must cut back on carbon emissions from transportation. But when you look at the whole picture of food production, the transportation part is a very, very small part of the overall environmental impact, and most of the environmental impact occurs at the production phase. So really what you want to try to do is produce foods where they can be most efficiently grown, and by efficiently I mean, you know, with both economically but also in terms of environmental impacts. So there are lots of studies I could point to, and probably one of the most prominent ones is an example where they did a sort of life cycle analysis, a sort of energy accounting. If Londoners would be better off, at least in terms of environmental consequences, of buying lamb grown in England or grown in New Zealand. And these particular researchers found that, in fact, they'd have a lower environmental sort of footprint if they bought from New Zealand. And the reason is because New Zealand is just naturally endowed with all the things that make sheep growing really easy. And moreover, even though it's 10,000 miles away, sea transportation is very energy friendly. You know, we had ships well before we ever had fossil fuels. So putting lamb on a boat and shipping across the ocean is a relatively energy friendly thing to do. And that's just one example. We could take all the other examples people give for local foods, and I do that in the book. I encourage the readers to go check out the book, and I try to present evidence. So I'm not just making an opinion. I'm trying to bring to bear evidence and science and economics to these kind of arguments.
Yeah. Are you saying that there should be no food regulation at all?
I'm not saying that at all. Again, what I'm calling for here is an evidence, science-based approach, and what I'm including in that science is the economic part of it as well. So I don't think that there's absolutely no role for government. And really, when I look at this, can I take a step back and ask, you know, why are people worried about a lot of these things in the first place? And a lot of it is the health and obesity issues. And really, if you kind of ask my opinion about what sort of the government's role is, a lot of those issues are very closely linked to the problems of poverty. And when you have people that live in an impoverished environment, they just don't have the incentives to think about their future selves and make investments in their education and in health that they can expect to pay off. And so I think in some cases, obesity, poor health are often more symptoms than causes. They're symptoms of a impoverished situation. And so I think if we can think about policies that promote growth and give people opportunities and hope that by investing in my health and in investing in myself, making human capital investments, that there'll be an incentive, there'll be a demand to want to be healthier because I have some expectation that's going to pay off for me in the future.
Talking with Jason Lusk, he is professor and endowed chair of the Agricultural Economics Department at Oklahoma State University and author of The Food Police, a well-fed manifesto about the politics of your plate. And we're wondering what you think about what you're hearing here. Do you think that there's too much government regulation of the food we eat? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, talking with Jason Lusk this hour. He's the author of The Food Police, a well-fed manifesto about the politics of your plate. He's talks about all the efforts of the so-called food police trying to keep you from eating the foods you want to eat. And I want to talk a little bit more about why he says we should be more accepting of conventionally grown and genetically modified food as well. Talk about you call organic food the fashion food. What do you mean by that, Professor Lusk?
Yeah, so if you don't mind, I'll take a little bit of a step back and just say that, one of the underlying themes of this book, too, is sort of I'm asking people to take a look at really what has been just a remarkable change in the quality, health, supply of food over the last 50 years and what's been happening on farms. And there's sort of a concern on my part, there's a mischaracterization of food and agriculture and farming in this country. And if you take a look at the changes that have been made, you just really see, in my mind, and I outline them in the book, the really wonderful changes that have been made. And yet when you approach the average person on the street, they know the best-selling books. They've seen the TV shows, and they think, oh, it's a terrible situation out there. And so I'm trying to remind people of what positive changes have been going about. And so this sort of points to your question. So there's sort of been a bit of a backlash in some ways about modern food technologies, modern commercial agricultural production practices. And one of those is associated with the organic movement that you referred to. And so organics, I think the issue is that people often subscribe to organics, or they attribute to organics a lot of attributes that the research shows are simply not there. And again, if anybody wants to buy organic food, I think it's fantastic. All I'm asking and what I'm advocating in this book is just that you have good arguments for buying organic and that you actually know the facts. That's all I'm trying to do is give people the facts. And when I look at a lot of the claims that people make about organic, they just don't stand up to the scientific literature. For example, the literature shows they're not more nutritious. You look at studies that have done blind taste tests, they're not any tastier. In terms of the environment, there are some environmental benefits of organic food, and I talk about that in the book, and I try to present both sides of the evidence. But there are also some environmental downsides that I also talk about. For example, yields for organic, many studies have shown, tend to be lower. And so what that means is you often have to bring more land into production to produce the same amount of food, and that's not an environmental benefit. And, last one is on the pesticide issue. A lot of people have this notion that organics don't use pesticides, but that's simply not true. They use, quote, natural pesticides. And some of those pesticides, like copper and sulfur, tend to be more toxic than some synthetic pesticides. That being said, I will admit that organics use a total, in general, on average, tend to use a lower volume of pesticides than conventional agriculture. But I also try to keep, ask people, how big of a deal is pesticide use in food anyway? And I try to look at that evidence and present what the science says on it. We have to remember the EPA regulates and USDA regulates a lot of this to begin with. And the argument I make in the book is that while pesticide use is a risk, it's a relatively small risk in the grand scheme of things.
We have callers waiting, so let's go to Pat in Richland Center. Hello, Pat.
Hey, good morning, and thank you so much, Joy, for having a guest on that takes this position, because it gives us an opportunity to ask questions. I wished I could ask more than one question here of this guest, but anyway.
Ask a question. Maybe you can.
Well, yeah, the question I'd like to ask this guest is, in the food supply in the United States of America, would he say that there are any monopolies, like Archer's Daniels Midland or Monsanto or the big major mega farms that grow the vegetables in California? Is there, any monopolies at work here in the food supply in America?
Hi, Pat. Thanks. That's a good question. And I know that's a big concern of a lot of people with the food sector. So, yes, of course, it's true. There are a lot of really big companies, agribusiness companies, that are involved in the food supply chain. And, if I had a magic wand and I could do it, I would try to create more competition in a lot of the food sector. I understand where some of those concerns come from. But at the same time, what I also would ask people to do, and again, I'm not advocating on behalf of these food companies. I don't work for them. I consider myself sort of an advocate on the behalf of consumers, is to look at what the research evidence on the impact of these companies. And it's easy to pick on a company like Monsanto, but we forget that Monsanto competes with Dow, with Bayer, with Syngenta, with many other companies in that sector. And so there is more competition often than first meets the eye. And when you look at the antitrust actions that have been taken, for example, in the meat packing industries, where maybe the top four companies produce about 80% of the beef, most of the research there shows that the effect of that concentration mainly comes about. The reason that concentration is there is because when you can get really big, you can also lower your costs dramatically. So, yeah, it's probably true. There's some market power. They're probably able to capture a bit more profit than they would be with more competition. But the cost-reducing effects, the price-lowering price effects that you and I see as a consumer, tend to outweigh those competitive effects. So again, I'm not advocating on behalf of food monopolies by any stretch. I'm just saying let's look at the research evidence on what the economic research shows on the effects of these companies.
Yeah, what's your follow-up, Pat?
Well, is that a yes, there is monopolies, or no, there isn't monopolies?
So I'm trying to bring a balanced discussion to this. As I say, it's not a monopoly. You might call it an oligopoly. There are several companies there, and the question is, what are the effects of it? And so it's not as black and white an issue, I think, as it might be made out to be. So it's not a yes or no issue.
Yeah. So should we fear Monsanto, Jason Lusk?
I'll let people make their own judgments about Monsanto. What I'll say is you shouldn't fear biotechnology. So I'm not an advocate of Monsanto at all. I'm an advocate when it's properly regulated and when it's been properly tested of biotechnology. And the reason is because these technologies are, unlike what a lot of people suggest, are stringently regulated. They are in many different countries. And you look at the potential benefits of these technologies, they are really immense. So they have the potential to lower food prices for food consumers. And maybe we in the United States think, well, you know, I don't know, a 10% price reduction, that doesn't do much for me. But we have to remember there are a billion people in this world that the United Nations tells us are hungry and starving today. Moreover, some of the herbicide, or at least the pesticide-resistant technologies, allow farmers to use less pesticide. Even the herbicide-resistant varieties, if you look at the research, shows that farmers that adopt those also tend to adopt no-till conservation tillage practices. And I think the real promise is in all the scientific research that's being done, often by nonprofit groups, for example, the research that's funded by the Gates Foundation on using biotechnology to breed in micronutrients into staple crops for consumers in the developing world. So, you know, biotechnology is not a cure-all, and yes, as the guest alluded to, there might be some instances where companies have monopolized certain genes. But in general, I think biotechnology has a lot of promise that I hope we won't shut the door to.
If there's nothing to fear from genetically modified crops or foods, why not put a label on those foods just to let consumers make the choice as to whether they want to eat it or not?
So actually, if you don't want to eat genetically modified foods, there is a label you can use, and it's called organic. And so the organic production standards, one of the rules of organics is they can't use biotech products. So to the extent that consumers want that choice, it is available in the market. And again, the question kind of comes back to this question of whether we should mandate companies requiring a label. There are already many companies that voluntarily advertise produce without biotechnology. And again, the question is, do we want to require it? And I think that requires some economic research. And I think it's kind of tough to know what the actual impacts of that kind of regulation might have effects that people don't anticipate. For example, in Europe, one of the things that's happened is that there's not no biotech in the market, but even though they have voluntary labeling, what it's done is it's sort of kept out biotechnology there. And as a consequence, food prices are a lot higher there than they are here. So, again, I think it takes a research answer. In my mind, it's not sufficient to say consumers have a right to know. You have to ask what are the costs and benefits of mandating that sort of information. And I think we actually got to do the calculations and figure that out.
I'm Joy Cardine talking with Jason Lusk, who is the author of The Food Police. And our next caller is Chris in Madison. Hello, Chris.
Hello?
Yes, go ahead, Chris.
Oh, hi. Thanks for having me on. Does your book talk about the corn subsidy at all?
Yeah, so...
What about it, Chris?
Well, that the fact that corn is artificially low because we subsidize it with our taxpayer dollars, and then they take the corn syrup and they pump it into everything. And then essentially they're growing diabetes and obesity. And that seems like the organic industry doesn't have that kind of support. And it seems like any pushback on the corn syrup industry is good. I mean, it seems almost unregulated. And if you don't mention that in your book or it's not even brought up, it seems like you're kind of picking on the little thing and not looking at the big picture.
Yeah, good question, Chris. In fact, I have a whole chapter on farm policy, so I'd encourage readers to check it out. And as I say in the book, I'm not a fan of current farm policies, at least the subsidy policies. And as far as I'm concerned, I'd be happy if they went away. I don't think we should be sort of trying to control the market of which products reach the market. What I will say, though, and I'm not trying to advocate on behalf of the current farm subsidies. I've already told you my position on that. But let's look at the research on what the farm subsidies do, and the research that shows that if you removed some of these subsidies, they'll have very small price impacts. The other thing to keep in mind, too, is there are a lot of other policies that drive up the price of corn. For example, we have the ethanol policies that makes corn more expensive. We have conservation reserve, the CRP program, conservation reserve program, that tends to pay farmers for taking land out of production. You also have to remember when it comes to sugar that there is a tariff. We have a quota system for cane sugar in this country, so that's driving up the price of substitute uses of sugar. And so when you look at farm policy, it in my opinion, is really a convoluted mess, and it's not as simple as saying, look at the subsidies, corn's cheaper than it would be otherwise. There's actually a lot of other policies that are pulling up the price of corn beyond what it would be, and there are even other policies that are driving up the price of alternative forms of sugar. And when everything nets out, this is not just my own opinion. You can look at the research that's been done. And it tends to show if you remove these subsidies that it would have very, very small effects on food prices.
Let's go to Cody in Madison. Hello, Cody.
Hello. The previous caller actually just kind of addressed something I was going to ask about. You had recently mentioned not subsidizing your local farmer, and I was going to just ask his opinion on the subsidies. I know Wisconsin Congressman Ron Kind had made a big effort to reduce or get rid of farm subsidies for years in the farm bill, and has kind of lost that battle year in and year out. But the last caller kind of addressed it, and your guest kind of addressed his opinion just based on, you know, farm subsidies in general, not just corn, but subsidies to larger producers based on yield and not need, and just kind of the policy behind that. But your caller addressed it, so.
Okay.
So can I follow up on Cody's comment, though? Because, you know, again, there's a lot of stuff in this book. I encourage readers to check it out. And it is true that larger farmers do receive a larger total subsidy, but when you look at the sort of subsidy per, you know, bushel of corn produced or per bushel of soybeans, actually smaller farmers get larger subsidies, and one of the reasons is on a per unit of production basis. And so one of the reasons is there are payment limitations that limit the amount large farmers can get. And what I will say in terms of the whole theme of the book, you know, is where I differ from, let's say, the Michael Pollans or Mark Bittmans of the world is I say let's get rid of all the farm subsidies. But what they'll also say is what we should do is get rid of the corn and soybean ones, but then add subsidies for fruits and vegetables. And I'll just leave it to the reader to see what I think about that in the book. But I present some reasons why I think that might not be a good idea.
No, why wouldn't that be a good idea?
Well, so let's, as I've already mentioned, the current farm subsidies don't actually do much to change food prices. So, again, we're spending money to try to create a benefit that may not even be there.
Well, I'm not sure. You know, it may be food prices, but what about the health of the food?
Yes. So let's talk about that. That's kind of an interesting counterintuitive thing. Again, I'm asking for people to look at the evidence, not just have gut reaction, feel good kind of policies. And what I ask in the book is, you know, which commodities do you think use the highest volume of water, pesticides, herbicides, and fungicides? It's not corn, it's not soybeans, it's not wheat, it's often the fruits and vegetables. And so if people are worried about pesticide use and herbicide use and these things in agriculture, subsidizing fruits and vegetables would bring a lot more of those kinds of things onto the market. As I've already argued, I think the research shows those, when properly used, as the EPA and FDA and USDA regulate, they're not as big a health risk as a lot of people point out, but I am pointing out there could be some adverse consequences of these policies that people haven't anticipated.
How about the health advocates, the food advocates who say get this corn syrup out of everything?
Yeah, so again, I'm not a nutrition expert, and I'm not going to, I'm picking on people for not paying attention to the economics, so I'm not going to pretend to be a nutritionist. And so I'll say if you want advice on whether corn syrup is any more or less healthy than beet sugar or cane sugar, then turn to a nutritionist and see what they have to say about the issue. What I will say is that if you as a consumer demand new things out of the food production system, if you want natural sugar, you can bet food companies are going to provide it. And in fact, that's what they do. So you can now find some sodas advertising made with real sugar and those kinds of things. And so, I guess that's maybe you're going to get to this in a minute, but that's sort of often, I think, at a sort of ideological level, differ with a lot of people, the sort of food police. They sort of view, I think, food companies, food agribusinesses as a real drain on the system, as really nefarious. But the way I look at them is that they're just trying to make a dollar, and the only way they can do that is give us stuff we'll buy. So we like to say things on surveys like, wow, I wish things were healthier and I wish things were whatever. But when we walk in that grocery store, what we tend to do is buy the least expensive stuff. And food companies can only stay in business if they give us what we'll buy. And so those food companies will respond to our every whim if we will express it in the marketplace. And indeed, when you go into a grocery store, you see all kinds of labels like low fat, low sodium, high in omega-3s, or if you go in fast food restaurants, you can see salads and wraps. So companies will provide us the things we want if we're willing to pay for them.
Talking with Jason Lusk, he is the author of The Food Police, a well-fed manifesto about the politics of your plate. He's also a professor and endowed chair of the Agricultural Economics Department at Oklahoma State University. 1-800-642-1234 if you have a question or concern. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up after 9, Kathleen Dunn is with you. Kathleen and her guest talking about the future of equal pay legislation. We're talking with Jason Lusk, who is the author of The Food Police, and our next caller is Dave in Wanakee. Hello, Dave.
Yes, hello. Hello, Professor. I'm curious if when food manufacturers process food and they do tests on food to make it more palatable, more desirable, are they fulfilling a need, a demand of the consumer, or are they creating a demand? And in doing so, aren't they taking away our choice?
So, good question, Dave. So there's a lot of things packed in that small question, so I'll try to do my best to answer them. So first, I sure hope these companies are trying to create foods that taste good to me. I don't know what else they're in the business of doing. So, are they creating a demand or are they fulfilling one? It's some of both. I never knew I needed heated seats in my car until suddenly I bought a used car that had one, and boy, they're fantastic. I wouldn't want to go back to the old ones. So that's sort of how technological innovative processes work, is they find ways of satisfying desires that sometimes we knew and we asked for, and sometimes we didn't even know we had. I didn't know I needed an iPad until they came along, but boy, it's sure wonderful to have. And so, these food companies are innovating. They're innovating, trying to find things that we like to taste and that we'll like to try again and again. And I think more power to them. Now, the question is, does that mean we should overindulge? Does that mean that licenses us to eat unhealthily? By no means does it do that.
I think when you think of potato chips, that what they're doing is trying to create a drug, and in which one potato chip doesn't satisfy your need. And they're engineering that in. That isn't something we asked for.
So I think the scientific evidence that these food ingredients are addictive is, you know, quite frankly, in my opinion, it's sort of stretching the science to fit an agenda. And it, in my mind, it sort of teeters on calling the evidence people present for that line of reasoning, in my mind, teeters on calling anything pleasurable addictive. And I don't think that's a very slippery slope to start going down. And I'll just give you a personal anecdote. I used to drink about 4 or 5 cans of Dr. Pepper a day. About 10 years ago, my pants started fitting a little too snugly. And so I thought I need to do something about this. So I quit. I switched to Diet Dr. Pepper, dropped about 20 pounds. I don't remember any withdrawal symptoms, sugars, or any shakes or anything of that nature. So that's just an anecdote, but I will say that there are several studies that done by people that deal in addiction and that really question this idea of whether these food ingredients are addictive in the same way that, say, you know, a narcotic is.
Let's go next to Tyler in Whitewater. Hello, Tyler.
Hello. Thank you for having this amazing topic. I'm actually an exercise physiologist, and hearing all of your callers calling in with myths about sugars, and whether it be corn sugar or beet sugar, sugar's sugar, and it's not creating diabetes. So I'd just really like to thank you guys for kind of touching on a topic that us exercise physiologists get very frustrated with because of all of the myths out there.
You know, so why, as an exercise physiologist, are you I'm just concerned about the sugar? You're thinking that eating too much sugar isn't what is making us fat?
It's people just not taking responsibility for the sugars they're putting in their body, because whether it's corn syrup or beet sugar in your, you know, regular cane sugar, anything, what you put in is what you should get out of your body, because calories in equals calories out.
Yeah. All right. Do you have any comment on that, Professor Lusk?
Yeah, I appreciate Tyler calling in. Actually, I'm really glad he did, because I'm a scientist. I've given, you know, numerous talks all over the U.S. at different universities and across the world. I interact with a lot of scientists, and the sort of passion in Tyler's voice is one I hear a lot, and that is, you know, sometimes we have these food journalists out there that are very persuasive. They write these best-selling books, or they have TV shows, and they're advocating these diets or even policies that the research just doesn't back up. And so the sort of frustration that I heard in Tyler's voice is one that I hear often among some of my colleagues in the scientific community.
Next we go to Pete in Reedfield. Hello, Pete.
Hi, I'm so excited to have gotten through, and I want to piggyback on Tyler's point and this concept. I guess I would characterize myself as a chastened food Nazi, and I'm a veterinary scientist, and my question really has to do, and I forget the author's name, and I want to remember it because I'm going to go out and get this book.
It's Jason Lusk.
Jason Lusk, L-U-S-K.
That's it.
And I what I'm curious about, I had the privilege of having dinner one time with Eric Schlosser, the author of Fast Food Nation. And again, as I started with Adele Davis's "Let's Eat Right to Keep Fit," you know, decades ago, and I'm just amazed at all the emotion that surrounds food. And I'm curious, you know, first of all, my guess is that you've taken a lot of flack, and you've got a handicap that you got a Southern accent. So here in Wisconsin, we consider a Southern accent a speech impediment. And we think you're not as bright as we are, but the second, you know, I'm just curious in what sort of backlash you've experienced, because I think that often it's like the lady doth protest too much, that I've got my left hand up and I say, you know, I, Pete, confess I'm a recovered food Nazi, but I think that you know, it's a punitive thing, that if I want to eat a bag of Cheetos, It's punitive to not do it. But anyway, I just am interested in what the reaction to your book is, and why you think there's been this, you know, sort of attack, Dr. Lusk. And I'll take my answer off the air. Over.
Thanks, Thanks, Pete. Well, I hope I'm not handicapped by my native Texas accent. But yeah, you know, the reactions to the book are a bit mixed, as I expected. I'm probably glad all of you can't see my email inbox and Twitter feed. I published an article that was in Huffington Post 2 days ago on organic food. There's about 300 comments, and you can read the kind of things people say about me there. You know, it's things that are absolutely not true, like, this guy's being paid to say this, Monsanto. You know, I've never received a check from Monsanto or any of those kind of companies. So, yeah, it's kind of an interesting thing, but it kind of does relate to this point of he kind of asked, you know, why are some of these feelings around and what circulates this? And I grew up in a very rural agricultural community, and I grew up working for farmers and working for food processors, and so you know, I think in many cases, and you have many fine farmers in Wisconsin, dairy farmers, corn farmers, and whatnot, and they, I think, often feel very beleaguered that their perspective is not being heard and that their point of view is not being expressed. And in fact, you know, you see things in best-selling books like, well, farmers just don't know what they're doing. They don't care. They're raping their land. They don't care about their health or their children. And that's just not true. And so in many ways, what I'm trying to do is provide a little bit of a voice for people in those communities, but in a reasoned and I think scientific way. So I don't know. You know, you can judge for yourself and come up with your own reaction. come up with your own reaction to my book.
Becky emails, your guest keeps telling us to look at the research, but too many times research is funded by the very conglomerates making millions with their monopolies. Also, his argument goes against common sense that should tell us that additives and altering the genes of foods cannot possibly be good for us. Aren't the rare cancers and diseases we hear so much of tell us that something is wrong?
Okay, so there were two important things there. One, this idea that all the research is funded by industry is just absolute nonsense. Sure, the industry funds some research, but on the issue of biotechnology, you know, the conclusions I'm drawing about the safety and environmental consequences of biotechnology come from the National Academies of Science. They come from statements by the American Medical Association. They come from reviews by committees of the United Nations, like the Food and Agricultural Organization. So these are not industry-funded groups. I agree. You wouldn't want to take a study just from either. It's not just industry. We also have to remember there are activists on the other side doing their own research, too, and you want to take all those with a grain of salt. So I say consider the big picture. Also, she kind of made this statement about, you know, changing genes and whatever else. Well, you know, I think the reality is when you look at the nature of food, I mean, we've been changing the genes of food for thousands of years. The ancestor of what we now consider modern corn was no bigger than your thumb. So we've been altering the genes of plants and animals around us, as I say in the book, since Adam spit the first seed on the ground. So that's just the nature of agriculture, is trying to find better ways of getting more and better food with less, and biotechnology is another step in that direction. I also want to kind of point out something people that I find a little ironic is, you know, some of the seed varieties that were around in the 1960s and 70s, they weren't genetically modified, but how did we get them? They created those seeds often by exposing them to radiation to get them to mutate, to try to create new varieties, and then we planted those. I find it ironic that people aren't all up in arms about that.
Let's go next to Anne in Kenosha. Hello, Anne.
Hi. I have a concern about biodiversity. I'm concerned when I find that companies like Monsanto are suppressing farms that don't use their patented technology to grow something, because I feel it leaves us vulnerable to something like the Great Potato Famine. Do you address that in your book?
So I talk a little bit about diversity. I don't know exactly what you mean by Monsanto suppressing farms. You know, farmers can decide what they choose.
Their soybeans are particularly well documented.
But what do you mean by suppressing?
Meaning that all the farms within an area must grow their crop, and taking farmers to court if they don't because of cross-pollination that will damage their patented version of the soybean.
So Monsanto can't force a farm to grow biotechnology or grow you know, GM soybeans, and each individual farm makes their own decision about what they want to
grow. Actually, they've taken people to court and made them stop the crops that they're farming. You will find documentation on that.
Yeah, that's true. So there have been a few instances. There's actually one at the Supreme Court right now where a farmer planted a Monsanto crop that he didn't pay for and was taken to court for it. But it's not the case that Monsanto can go to a farm and say, "You're going to grow my crop, or I'm going to sue you." They will, and they have sued farmers who have grown their crops without paying the appropriate licensing. And you know, again, I'm not going to defend Monsanto, but I'd be a little upset if people took my food police book and started selling it themselves, putting their name on it, and for 99 cents. So there is some role for property right protection here. Let's get to your bigger question, though. Get out of the weeds a little bit about biodiversity. You know, that's a big concern, I think, about a lot of people have about modern commercial agriculture, and you know, whether the so-called monocropping has some bad consequences. And again, you know, we have farmers out there. There are a lot of, as I said, probably a lot of good farmers in Wisconsin. And the question is, who gets to tell that farmer what to do on his land or her land? And I have a hard time believing that somebody in New York or Berkeley knows better, cares more about the health and viability of land near, you know, in, say, near Madison, Wisconsin, than the flesh and blood farmers who live there. And when you look at what a lot of the farmers actually do, it's a lot more diverse than often meets the eye. So they're rotating corn with soybeans. Those soybeans are fixating nitrogen in the soil. Often many of them will plant a cover crop of hay during certain times of the year. And so, you know, there is more diversity than sometimes meets the eye. Although, as Anne suggests, you know, there might be some, there are people have concerns about biodiversity issues. The other thing I'll point out, too, I know I'm kind of going long-winded on this, is when you look at the advancements in seed technology and farming technology that have happened, we produce a lot more food than we did 50 years ago. But the amazing thing is we do it with less land. And so what that means is that land that formerly would have been in agriculture is now freed up to be used for other purposes, nature, wilderness, and whatnot.
Last call from, let me see here, I pushed the wrong button. Last call is from Tom in Bayfield. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I'll try to make this as quick as I possibly can. I am a farmer. I use GMO crops. I use pesticides. I'm also on dairy. I've been farming now for close to 40 years. I cannot believe that it's about time we hear the conventional end of farming, how much safer that food is. And when I hear, I just get so mad when they talk about these factory farms. What is it? 95-98% of the farms in this country are owned by families. I've probably grown 4 or 5 times since I've been here. A lot of it's out of survival. Price of my pickups, price of my equipment is getting astronomical. I got to spread it over more land. And if people do not realize that if they get on this organic bandwagon, we cannot feed this country and the world by going at that route.
Thank you, Tom, for calling. We have just a minute for a response to that, Professor Lusk.
I'm glad Tom called in. And I think what I'm trying to do in the book is articulate some of the frustrations that he's expressing.
Yeah. So what is the takeaway? What do you want listeners to remember?
A couple of things. One is, you know, I want people to appreciate the benefits that have happened in food and agriculture and realize there's been many wonderful changes. And I think sometimes we get mired in this this mindset that everything's bad and we got to do something, and you know, appreciate the wonderful changes that have happened in food over the last 50 years. And the other thing is to express your own individualism and desire when it comes to food. You know, have some personal responsibility.
We'll leave it there. Thank you very much for being with us. Jason Lusk is a professor and endowed chair of the Agricultural Economics Department at Oklahoma State University and author of The Food Police, a well-fed manifesto about the politics of your plate. Thanks to Cynthia Schuster for producing and directing this program. Thanks to Amanda Magnus for on-air production. Thanks for listening. Tomorrow at this time, it's a look back at the top stories of the week during our Week in Review. tomorrow after 8. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.